Thank you, Paul, and good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. As Paul pointed out, I direct the Mobile Commerce Lab at Carnegie Mellon, so I do a lot of work in mobile and IoT. I also direct the master's program in privacy engineering. It's a recent program that we launched 4 years ago, and it's the only one of its kind where we're training people to work as privacy engineers in industry. Huge demand for people with that sort of background, and that's just a reflection of how much data is being collected today by a variety of different companies, and how companies, by and large, are very much struggling to figure how to balance their need for more and more data, because we're living in the data-centric economy, and obviously the regulations and expectations also that we, as users and consumers of these technologies, have. The last thing you want to do as a company is upset your users and lose their trust. So what I want to do today is I want to talk to you about some research that we're doing, in particular, in the area of privacy. This is, in some ways, a continuation of a talk I gave last year, except that we've continued to make great progress. And so in this presentation this evening, I will actually give you an update on the progress that we've made, in particular discussing technologies that we've been able to develop to help both regulators and users. Right, so those are actually two important constituencies. And as I'm going to point out, these technologies can also help developers. So we're really trying to serve the three main constituencies. If you think about privacy, right, you've got the users themselves, you've got the regulators, whose role is in part to protect, obviously, users and consumers, and then you've got, obviously, the producers of technologies that are consuming data. And so we want to ultimately help all three of these constituencies because we think that they all need quite a bit of help, as it turns out. So perhaps I should start with a quick outline of my presentation. So for those of you who are not necessarily very familiar with privacy, I'll start by introducing some of the basic concepts behind privacy, in particular the framework or the approach that people refer to as notice and choice. I'll briefly introduce it. I'm not going to give you a whole lecture on this. There's a lot to be talked about. Those of you who are actually in my class and are here this evening will get to hear more about all these issues in the context of my lectures in their class. We're going to talk about privacy in the age of IoT. I'm going to show you that this notice and choice model, which is the default approach for dealing with privacy today, is broken. It's already failed in the context of the fixed web, and it has, therefore, no chance whatsoever of scaling up to mobile or to IoT unless we develop new technologies. And I will present technologies that I believe can make a big difference in this space. I will discuss in particular two very large projects. These are two of the largest projects that we have in the United States in privacy. I happen to be leading both of these projects. One is called the Usable Privacy Policy Project, and the other one is called the Personalized Privacy Assistant Project. And I'm going to be discussing progress on the front of both of these projects. We'll see how these technologies can help users as well as regulators. And that's basically the plan for this evening. So feel free to interrupt me. We're a small group here, more than happy to make this interactive. So what is privacy? Basically, as I mentioned, a lot of privacy is a very broad concept. I'm not even going to try to define privacy today, but it's obviously an expectation that people generally have about their right to be left alone, right, free of disruption from companies as well as government entities. And that concept has taken many shapes and forms, and it's obviously embedded in foundational documents worldwide. So if you look, for instance, at the UN Charter for Human Rights, right, that clearly includes provisions dealing with privacy. If you're looking at the U.S. Constitution, for instance, we have the Bill of Rights that includes a number of amendments dealing specifically with privacy, free speech, the First Amendment, but also the Fourth Amendment, which has to do with the need to issue warrants and the need to have a due process if you want to start looking into people's belongings, go into their home, search their papers, and obviously nowadays also look at what is potentially on their mobile phones, right? So what I'm going to do this evening is I'm going to focus more on information privacy. And the concept of information privacy, as it's defined across all these foundational documents, is effectively a concept that deals with the right of people to control what information is being collected about them and to control also the purpose for which that information is being collected. And all these rights, by the way, and I'm not going to go deep into that, all these rights come obviously with some qualifications. So as I'm sure you realize, governments obviously claim and have claimed for many years that they should also have the right to potentially gain access to our data under certain conditions. For instance, to ensure that we're all going to be safe and that bad things will not happen. So there are obviously also qualifications that come along with these things. So in an IoT age, in an age also of mobile phones, right, where there's plenty of data being collected about us, the question is how do we reconcile these rights with all the information that's being collected? Pretty much every technology that you interact with today is collecting information about you. Obviously, your cell phone is collecting tons of information about you, but your car is also collecting information about you. Your utility company is collecting information about you. Your TV provider is collecting information about you. Your doctor is collecting information about you. Your smartwatch is collecting information about you, right? I can go on and on and on and on, right? And so as we're carrying out all sorts of different activities in the course of our daily lives, in fact, information is being collected all the time. This information is used in many ways for a number of very useful purposes, right? So using data, we can help people save energy. We can ensure perhaps that they're going to drive more safely. Perhaps we can improve their health and fitness outcomes. So there are all sorts of different reasons why we're trying to collect this information. But obviously, along with these benefits, there are also potentially some risks. There are potentially some scenarios that we as individuals may not necessarily feel comfortable with. And so the concept of information privacy, as I said, has to do with the ability that we as users and consumers will have to control these information flows, to control the data that's being collected about us and what happens to that data. And as I pointed out here, there are a variety of different scenarios, and not everyone necessarily feels the same way about these scenarios, right? So some of us are quite happy to carry smartphones, right, that collect our location wherever we go and that potentially share this information with a bunch of different players. Others might potentially be a bit more concerned about these scenarios and might want to restrict some of those scenarios. So it's not the case that one approach is better than the other. It's just the case that different people feel differently about these scenarios. And so that variety in preferences is in part a challenge that we've got to deal with when it comes to privacy. If it was a one-size-fits-all problem where everyone had the same preferences, it would be very easy to basically say, okay, those scenarios, nobody on this planet feels comfortable with them, therefore they're not going to be allowed. Those scenarios, everyone feels comfortable with them, therefore they're going to be allowed. Unfortunately, there's a continuum of preferences that people have. And so the concept of no decent choice is about giving enough information to people so that they can make a meaningful decision. This is about informed consent. That's the term, or notice and choice, notifying people about these data collection and sharing practices and enabling them to make a decision on that basis. Right, and so that's the basic idea behind information privacy, notice and choice. So notice and choice, how does this work in practice? Well, in practice, if you go to the web, right, and you browse from one website to another, in practice, you have privacy policies. And these privacy policies are there to effectively satisfy this expectation of notice and choice, this expectation that somehow you should be able to find out what data has been collected by a given website and for what purpose it's being collected. In practice, right, and we can do a quick show of hands here, how many of you have read a privacy policy over the past month? All right, I'm not terribly impressed. You have? Fantastic. You must be a privacy advocate or working in privacy. Did you read the entire privacy policy? Probably? Okay. Was it a short one or was it a long one? Did it take you 5 minutes, 10 minutes, longer? 10 minutes. 10 minutes, sounds about right, yes. And after reading that policy, did you feel that you had the information you needed? Yeah. That's fantastic. So, but you're only the only one in this room. And so if you just do the stats here, this is not terribly, terribly impressive. So in practice, these privacy policies take about 10 minutes to read. Some of them are a bit shorter, some of them are a bit longer. Studies have been conducted that have shown that if you wanted to read every privacy policy of every technology that you interact with during the course of the year, you'd probably be spending about 2 months every year just reading these privacy policies. The sad news beyond that is that even if you read these privacy policies, you will still be left wondering what you've actually read. So reading it doesn't necessarily mean understanding it. So you were very lucky to find a policy, or perhaps you're an expert. But most people find these policies to be very long, and they find them to not necessarily be terribly, terribly helpful. Excuse me. So if this is already not working terribly well, right, and we can actually, you know, relax the question, how many of you have read a privacy policy, entire privacy policy over the past 6 months? I assume you're going to raise your hand because you raised your hand for 1 month, right? So, but I'm not getting more hands. I'm still getting one hand. How about over the past year? How about a fraction of a privacy policy over the past year? Yes. So I'm getting two hands now. I'm assuming you would raise your hand too, but you're tired of raising your hand.
I want to give a feedback. You know, what's the point after reading it? You don't have a choice.
You don't have a choice?
You don't really have a choice. You know,
so
they're collecting the information, your choice is only visiting their network, visiting their website, or you don't. Right?
That's a very good point. So there is clearly a dearth of options giving to users. This idea of notice and choice assumes that not only you're going to be notified, but you're also going to be given some options. The number of options you're given tends to be very limited. I will actually show you research that we've conducted that aims at systematically identify what these options are. They're often not very easy to find, but there are actually options on many sites. There are options. They're limited. They're not going to give you the right to opt out of the things that are most critical to them, but there are actually a few choices here and there that you can find if you look very carefully. And one of the technologies that we've developed, and I'll mention it later this evening, is actually a technology that tries to help users actually uncover those options that are available to them. So there is actually technology that you can develop that will read the privacy policy and that will zoom in on potential options, if there are any, that might be available to you, so that you don't necessarily have to, you know, spend 10 minutes searching for these options and potentially finding out that there is really not very much, right? So, very good point. So, if this is already not working terribly, terribly well, right, on the fixed web, what are the chances it's going to work well on mobile phones, right? If you're not reading privacy policies on the large screen that your laptop or desktop offers you, what are the chances you're going to read those privacy policies on a smartphone? Even if you've got a phablet, I can't imagine that you're going to read too many of these policies. What about IoT, right? In IoT, for instance, Paul was talking about his Nike sensor, right, on his shoe. I don't think that the Nike sensor has actually a screen that you can even hope to read the privacy policy on. Now, in truth, there's an app that comes along with that, and so you could go back and try to read the policy on the app. But the point is that in an IoT context, this is actually one of the easier scenarios. This Nike sensor is one that Paul was aware of. He bought it, he installed the app on his cell phone. He was actually aware of that technology. As I've entered this room here, I can see a camera here, so I'm assuming that I'm being videotaped, and I've obviously put microphones on, so I assume that my voice is also being recorded. But there are other environments where the technology is completely invisible. You don't even know that it's there. So how are you going to read the privacy policy associated with that technology if you don't even realize that that technology is there in the first place? So those are the kinds of challenges that we're faced with. So this notice and choice model is really not going to scale up. It's already failed on the fixed web, and it's not going to scale up very well to mobile and IoT unless somehow we develop new technologies that are going to help overcome these challenges, that are very much usability challenges, right? The fact that these notice and choice approaches to notice and choice, right, these privacy policies are just not usable. They're not there for you to really consume. Another example would be mobile apps on your cell phone, right? So a typical user today has somewhere between 50 and 100 apps, right? If an app requires, on average, three different permissions, those permissions are basically the settings where you authorize an app to access sensitive information, like your location, like your contacts lists, like perhaps the heart rate monitor. If an app requires, on average, three permissions, and you've got even just 50 apps on your phone, that's 150 different settings that you have to configure. Nobody configures 150 settings on their smartphones. And so these are the kinds of things that we're dealing with here today. And so hopefully by now I've made my point. There's a lot of data being collected about us. This data is being collected for all sorts of different purposes. By and large, most of us are not aware of the reasons why this data is being collected, the privacy policies that are there in principle to inform us about the purpose for which this data is being collected are unreadable, they're just too long, and often the context within which we would want to even gain access to these policies is such that it makes it completely unrealistic to expect anyone to actually read these policies. Nobody reads these policies today. And so the question is, right, could we somehow develop technology that could help overcome this obstacle, right, this obstacle to ultimately the adoption of mobile and IoT types of technologies. Today, most of us are using mobile and IoT technologies, but you can easily imagine a stage where unless there's better communication with users, there's going to be more and more surprises, and people will eventually get upset when they find out what happens to their data. And so one of our projects at Carnegie Mellon is a project that's referred to as the Usable Privacy Policy Project. And this is a project where we've been combining crowdsourcing machine learning and natural language processing to semi-automatically analyze privacy policies and extract meaningful statements from the text of these privacy policies. So the goal is to no longer require people to read the policies, but instead to semi-automatically or even automatically analyze these policies and identify, as you read these policies, statements that are likely to be of interest to you. And because different people care about different things, right, we would want to be able to even customize the interfaces that we're going to use to communicate those statements to users. One person may not care about his location being shared with advertisers, another one might. One person might already expect something to take place, another one might not. And so I would want to have interfaces that are going to leverage that knowledge to highlight different things to different people so as to minimize the amount of time that's required from you, right, to be aware, to effectively be informed about the privacy practices associated with the technology with which you interact. And so one aspect behind this is to do the crowdsourcing and automatic analysis of policies. The other aspect is the presentation behind that. And so we've been able to develop these technologies to a point where today we can actually analyze policies at scale. I'm going to show you an example where we've analyzed about 20,000 policies in a matter of about half an hour, right, and identified violations in these policies, violations with regard to different types of regulations, or likely violations, I should say. We still believe that it's very important for people to manually check any sort of violations. So we're not trying to completely get rid of the lawyers, or at least not just yet. To start, perhaps, I should point out that crowdsourcing really works, right? So crowdsourcing is the idea that you're going to leverage the wisdom of the crowds, that you're going to effectively engage a relatively large population of users and rely on them to answer a bunch of different questions. So that's certainly a viable approach. You've got sites like Wikipedia, for instance, that rely on that. You've got entirely different approaches that we've discussed in class. For instance, the crowdsourcing that takes place to evaluate traffic conditions, right? This is all effectively different people who carry smartphones with GPS devices that are reporting the speed at which they travel, and this data being analyzed by companies like Google to determine whether or not you're stuck in traffic. Now, you might say, how can you use crowdsourcing, right? If you just told me earlier that when people read privacy policies, often they're still left wondering what they've read. Well, as it turns out, we've been able to develop interfaces that effectively enable people to do a pretty good job at reading privacy policies. A lot of this has to do with breaking down the tasks and helping people by informing them about what are potentially valid answers to different sets of questions. So very often when you read a privacy policy, if I ask you a question such as, does this site share your location with advertisers, you might read a privacy policy and you may not be able to tell. So it's important when you have a crowdsourcing interface, for instance, to allow people to say, I cannot tell, as the answer, rather than requiring them to always say yes or no. And so we've developed tools that actually have a number of different options that are being given to crowd workers. And we've been able to show that, in fact, when you rely on crowd workers to read privacy policies and answer questions or fragments of privacy policies, they can ultimately do a pretty good job. They're not necessarily going to be able to answer everything, but the good property that we found is that when they converge, that means when you get some majority of users, of crowd workers, to converge on a given answer, most of the time their answer is correct. They don't always converge, and so there are situations where we don't necessarily know what the answer is, and that's fine. But when they do converge, most of the time they're correct. So, for instance, if you require agreement of about 80% of your crowd workers on a given question, you're going to get actually quite a few answers to be correct. So you're going to be able to answer about 75% of the questions that you might have. You're going to get a small number here, just a few percent. I think it's about 2% of the answers that are going to be wrong. Okay. And then you're going to get some number of answers for which you're not going to get an answer, some number of questions for which you're not going to get an answer. So that's the good news. And so we've been able to leverage data that we've collected in this manner from a number of crowd workers for a number of different policies. In fact, we've refined this process over the past 3 years. We've played with a number of different interfaces. We now have an approach that involves multiple steps. So one of the things that we do is we look at a policy, we break down that policy into segments or paragraphs. We label these paragraphs in terms of the practices that are being discussed in these paragraphs. So a paragraph might be discussing about data collection types of practices, what data is being collected by a site. Another paragraph might be dealing with data sharing practices. So who is this data going to be shared with? A third paragraph might potentially deal with choices. So are there any options that are being given, for instance, to users? A fourth paragraph might have a combination of different practices that it might be discussing. These provisions might have to do, for instance, with international laws. So, for instance, are there specific provisions to deal with EU citizens, right? Are there specific provisions to deal with residents from California? California has among the strictest privacy policies in the United States. The United States doesn't have typically very, very strong privacy policies, but California has something called CALOPA, the California Online Privacy Protection Act, that provides you with some amount of protection as a user of technology. So we're segmenting the policies, we're annotating the policies, and then within these policies, based on the different kinds of practices that have been identified, either through machine learning or through crowdsourcing, we then collect finer annotations. So for instance, if this is a paragraph that deals with the collection of data, we may want to get crowd workers or we may rely on machine learning to identify exactly what data is being collected. Is it location data? Is it unique device ID? Is it a contacts list, for instance, if you have a smartphone, and this is a policy for an app on a smartphone? So those are the kinds of things that we do. And so this is an example of an interface to effectively get crowd workers to look at privacy policies. So you're seeing here that we have a number of different types of practices that people can identify. If, for instance, you identify that this paragraph deals with first-party collection and use, the first party just refers to the entity that's behind, for instance, the website or behind the app. So what is it that this entity is collecting? And then you can get people to start annotating different fragments of text within this paragraph and indicate, in fact, what is being disclosed. So, for instance, here we see that receive and store any information on our website. You can choose not to provide certain information. So this is an example where you actually have a choice. But then you might not be able to take advantage of many of our features. Okay, so those are the kinds of statements that you find very often in privacy policies. And so we've actually developed interfaces to, on the one hand, collect this information from typically law students or actually from the public at large using Amazon Turk. And then we've used this data and all these annotations, and we've got actually a fairly large corpus of data today, to train machine learning classifiers and see to what extent we can actually automate this process. And so the result of this research has led to a website today that has actually received quite a bit of publicity over the past few months. It's a website where you can actually go and explore different privacy policies, compare websites in terms of how they operate and what they do. These color codes here correspond actually to colors representing different types of statements that you can find in the policy. So very often, a policy might start, in fact, with first-party collection and use statements. Then you might have some third-party sharing. And so these different colors actually correspond to different kinds of statements and different kinds of practices as they're being disclosed. I didn't get to check whether we have a browser that's available on this computer, but I might actually try to go to the website and perhaps give you a better sense for how this works. Yes, but before we do that, I'm sure there is a browser that's working. So this is a slightly more detailed view. For instance, in this case, you can go to the website, for instance, for PlayStation. And what this site does, beyond the ability to actually click on these different practices and explore them and understand exactly what's being said here, it also gives you some additional statistics in terms of how many practice statements this policy has, what grade level you need to have to actually read these policies. So there are all sorts of techniques that have been developed over the years to measure how sophisticated a reader you need to be to understand a piece of text. As it turns out, for the PlayStation, you need to have a PhD, right, to understand the privacy policy. This is not terribly, terribly uncommon. If you go and look at the Disney website, I think you need a grade of 18. Grade of 12 obviously means completing high school, right? 16 would mean completing your bachelor's degree, and 17, I guess you need to be doing a master's degree. So students in a master's program should be able to understand these policies, right? And so then you can start clicking on these things. For instance, if I want to know what choices does this policy give me, going back to your question here, apparently there are some options in terms of opt-in, and so you can actually identify immediately the text within that policy that corresponds to this. So visitors to a website may be given the opportunity to opt in to two different programs. The first option is to receive marketing content from SCEA. This is basically Sony, as far as I can tell. And the second is to have personal information shared with Sony's third-party partners that they may send you, so that they may send you marketing material. So that's effectively the kinds of things that we can do. And we've made this available, so let me see if I can quickly get out of this presentation, find a browser, and perhaps show you in practice how this works. And I'm not going to spend too much time on that because there's a lot more I want to cover, but just perhaps a minute here. So the site is explore.usableprivacy. I think it's like this, .org. If I can connect to that. It wants my email to browse. So much for privacy here. So do you need to actually...
No, you don't.
You don't, right? Hopefully you don't.
You don't.
Right, so...
You don't. It's because,
there we go.
Yeah.
I think we're getting there.
Yeah, it was Google
doing that. Yeah, Google likes, you obviously know a lot about us. And so here we go. So this is the website. So suppose, for instance, that I decide to go and explore this PlayStation website. Right, so PlayStation here. Right, so let's go back to it and see how this works. And for some reason, this is not terribly, terribly fast, so I think this demo will not be very long. But suppose, for instance, that you want to know to what extent you have... We've already looked at choice, so we're not going to do that, although we could look at it again. You see here that this is going to highlight the different parts in the privacy policy where you've got statements. So there are three statements dealing with opt-in. You can quickly zoom in and actually find those statements. Suppose that you want to find out about statements related to children. Apparently, there are two statements that relate to children. Here, policies for children. So Sony does not knowingly collect PII, personally identifiable information, for children under the age of 13. And Sony, et cetera, right? So similar kinds of things. If you want to know about California law, right? So apparently there is a statement here that deals specifically with California law. And so these are the kinds of things that you can explore with this website. So these are the benefits of doing this type of analysis. And if you're interested, you're more than welcome to play with this website. I actually remember now that I even brought something. I brought some marketing material. So let me see if I can actually retrieve it from my pocket here, and you're welcome to pass this around. So this is actually advertising the website. So if you're curious and there is a website that you want to explore, not all websites are there. It's actually a small number of websites right now. But we're planning to continue populating this site with more sites and more practices as we continue. So we have a corpus of a policy. So this is based on 115 different policies that have been fully annotated by a number of law students. And we're using this basically as our gold standard for machine learning. So we've been able to train a number of different classifiers. What is the size of this corpus? You're looking at about 23,000 different types of data practices, about 128,000 attribute value selection. So that's a pretty meaningful corpus, if you think about it. And the question is, now, can you start building classifiers, right, to recognize different types of data practices as they're being disclosed in these privacy policies and potentially identify policy violations or likely policy violations, right? So we're not recommending that you rely solely on what this site will identify. We strongly recommend that, for instance, we're working with the California Attorney General right now. We strongly recommend that they manually check whatever it is that we come up with because, number one, there are different interpretations to these laws, and obviously, number two, it's always possible. This is machine learning, so you never get 100% accuracy. But I'm going to show you that the accuracy is actually pretty good. And so the approach that we've taken is an approach where we're doing two things. We're focusing on mobile apps in this case. The approach that we're doing is an approach where we're analyzing the text of the privacy policies and collecting statements that these policies make or the absence of statements about things that they should be disclosing, right? And in parallel with that, we're also looking at the code of the apps. So apps, for instance, in the Android store, right, can easily be downloaded, especially free apps, right? You can download the free apps, you can decompile them, right? And my lab has been doing that for a number of years now. We're well known for having decompiled over a million apps, right, and looked at the code of these apps. And we also have a website that discloses all this, so you can look at ratings of apps based on what they do and what information they collect. So you can decompile these apps. You can look at their use of third-party libraries, and those third-party libraries are typically indicative of information that the app is sharing, obviously, with third parties. You can look within the code at the calls to the APIs corresponding to these third-party libraries and the calls to the sensitive Android APIs that enable these apps to collect sensitive information and pass that sensitive information on to third parties. So you can effectively compare what the privacy policy says with what the code actually does. And you can see if these things are actually consistent. Right? So you could do this for two reasons. One is you could do this to help a company to make sure that this company actually has a privacy policy that's consistent with what their code is doing, right? Or you could develop this tool, right, to support regulators and enable them to go after companies, right? And we believe that both are actually needed, right? We much prefer if companies were using these tools to fix the problems, right? We're not excited when companies do things that are wrong and regulators need to fall on them and fix things. But in fact, you need both kinds of ways of deploying this technology. And so the approach, as I said, relies on the one hand on machine learning to analyze privacy policies and what is known as static analysis to analyze the code of these apps. And then we can check whether or not these things are compliant or whether there are potential violations. So this is very recent research, actually. This paper that I'm presenting today is a paper that's currently under review. It's not been published yet. So this is really hot from the oven, right? So let me briefly explain some of the things that we've been looking at in particular. So privacy is very complex, right? There are different regulations worldwide. Here in Hong Kong, you've got the Hong Kong Data Privacy Ordinance, right? In Europe, you've had the Data Protection Directive since 1995, implemented in 1998. It's actually currently being overhauled. Europe has just passed something known as the GPRD, the General Privacy Regulation Directive, GPRD, exactly. And the GPRD actually imposes even more stringent requirements than the original EU Data Protection Directive. We've done this analysis primarily looking at the US landscape, but in fact, there is nothing that prevents someone from taking the same approach and adapting it to, for instance, the requirements here in Hong Kong or the requirements in Europe. So in the US, obviously, there is no federal mandate that cuts across all sectors, in contrast, for instance, to Europe or in contrast to Hong Kong, where the data protection, the data privacy ordinance really cuts across all the different sectors. But there are a number of relevant laws and regulations. So, for instance, we have in the US something called COPPA. COPPA is the Children Online Privacy Protection Act. And so it pertains to data that you collect about children 13 and under. It requires parental consent. It requires the existence of a privacy policy if you're collecting sensitive information, all sorts of things along those lines. We have also the Fair Information Practices Principles. That's not a law, but there are actually some requirements that are mandated under the Fair Information Practices Principles that come out of the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission. Those principles require, in particular, that if you're going to be collecting personally identifiable information, you should have a privacy policy. You have, in California, as I've mentioned, the California Online Privacy Protection Act. Delaware also has fairly stringent requirements. Anyone who is building an app, right, for the United States market, in effect, will have to comply with the California laws, because nobody is building different variations of an app four different states in the United States. So in many ways, the California regulations are driving the requirements in the U.S. And so I'm going to sort of leave it at that, but I'll just briefly mention some of the things that we're going to be looking at. So in general, there are some requirements coming out of some of these regulations to just have a privacy policy, right? So for instance, under COPPA, right, if you are going to be dealing with an app, for instance, that's directed to children, you're required to have a privacy policy. That's the end of the story. If you don't have a privacy policy, you're effectively in violation of COPPA. CALOPA, for instance, requires that if you're collecting PII, PII stands for personally identifiable information. Examples of PII, right, include a unique device identifier, includes also your location, includes also your contacts list, for instance, on your smartphone, right? Those are very popular APIs. Those are very popular permissions that many apps, in fact, request. If you're going to be collecting that type of information, accessing that type of information, then CALOPA requires also that you disclose it in a privacy policy, right? So there are a number of requirements, and this is represented here by the fact that there are requirements just to have a privacy policy. If you don't have a privacy policy and you have an app directed to children, you're in violation right there. That's very easy to detect, right? Either you have a privacy policy or you don't. There are some requirements dealing, for instance, with the change. If you're making a change to your privacy policy, how are you going to notify users, right? So CALOPA and DOPA, the Delaware Online Privacy Protection Act, require that you actually describe your practices when it comes to changing your privacy policy. If that's not being described, right, so this is something that we're going to refer to as notice of policy change. I've come up with abbreviations for this. If you don't notify people about how they might be able to access their data, potentially edit their data and delete their data, right, you might also be in violation under some of these laws. I think Delaware law in particular, if I remember correctly, but I'm not a lawyer, so sometimes I make mistakes, NAED, right? So we're going to refer to notice of access, edit, and delete, right? Try to remember these acronyms, but I'll refresh your memory as we look at different stats. Collection of identifiable information. We're going to look at unique device identifier. This is like a super cookie, basically, right? That if you have an app that tracks your unique device identifier and your location, right, and it passes this information onto an advertising network, and that advertising network gets the same information from 10 other apps, and you've got that same unique device ID coming from all these 10 different apps, the advertising network is able to build a very comprehensive picture of all your whereabouts across all these different apps. So CL, we're going to look at the collection of location. CC, we're going to look at the collection of contact information. And then we're going to look also at the sharing of this information. So that's where the S comes from. Right. So those are things that we're going to be looking at. And so we're going to try and see to what extent we can build classifiers that look at privacy policies and are able to determine to what extent there is a policy that discloses this type of practice, collection and sharing of this type of information. Right. So that's, in a nutshell, why we're doing that. We're doing that because this has real meaning with regard to regulations that are in force in the United States. And in fact, this has real meaning with regard to regulations here in Hong Kong as well as in Europe. And so this is a high-level chart. I'm going to keep this relatively short. That shows you that we can do what I've already described at a high level. We can look at the code of apps. We can analyze this code, and we can tell what this code is doing in terms of collection of sensitive information, the sharing of that sensitive information also with third parties. And so we've developed effectively a factory that's able to process these things. We decompile the apps, right? We can run these things. So I'll, for instance, mention how we've processed about 20,000 apps for the purpose of this study. This takes about half an hour, right, to basically decompile 20,000 apps and look at everything that these apps are doing. So very, very doable, very scalable, if you think about it. And so we've been able to do that, and we've built classifiers for each one of these different practices that I've mentioned, right? So for instance, the collection of location, the sharing of location, etc. And so those are the kinds of results that you're getting, right? So how good are these classifiers? So I'm not going to give you a machine learning lecture, but anyone who is working in machine learning knows that there is something known as the F-score. The F-score is basically a measure that combines both precision and recall. These are the two things that you care about in machine learning. precision is you want to make sure that when you say that something is of label X, that something is indeed of label X. You don't want to be wrong most of the time, right? And recall is when you have a bunch of different data items that are of label X. The question is, how many, what percent of those label X items are you going to be able to actually identify, right? So if you're only identifying 10%, that's not very much. What you ideally want to do is identify all the items that have label X and correctly label them as label X, right? And so if you do that, then you're going to have an F score that's going to be very close to 1. And so the scores that you're seeing here, right, are basically the kinds of scores that we're getting with the different classifiers that we've built for each one of the practices that we discussed earlier. For instance, this is the sharing of contacts, this is the sharing of location, this is the sharing of ID, right? This is as evaluated based on a corpus of 115 policies that I was telling you about earlier. So we're actually doing a pretty good job here. And we're looking at F1 negative, that's a technical issue. We're looking in this case for the absence of a statement, right? So what is particularly bad in this context when you're looking at a privacy policy is an app that does X but does not disclose X when it's actually required to disclose X. So we want to make sure that when it comes to saying there is no such statement in a policy, we're actually pretty good at doing that, right? So these are the kinds of things that we're doing on the analysis of the privacy policies. Now let's look at the opposite side of things, right? Let's look at our analysis of what is happening in the code. So again, we're looking at these different practices that we've discussed, the collection of device ID, location, right, contacts, and the same thing for the sharing. And here again, we're looking at how well our analysis of the code works. And the way in which we've determined that is by actually manually analyzing a bunch of different apps and comparing the performance of our factory, if you want, with the manual analysis by people who are pretty good at analyzing code and looking for privacy issues. And as you can tell, this is even better, right? We're pretty much getting close to 100% in a number of different practices, like the sharing of contacts, the sharing of location, and those kinds of things. So we seem to be doing a pretty good job. It's not 100% accurate. So there could be, you don't want to go to court based on this. You clearly want to say, okay, let's look more closely at what's going on. But this is clearly a method that's going to work in terms of raising flags, right? So you're going to raise a red flag, and then someone will invest a bit more time and say, okay, let's double check and make sure that this is, in fact, correct. So what are the kinds of findings that you come up with when you do this sort of analysis? So this is an analysis of about 18,000 different mobile apps, right? The first thing that we realize when we look at these 18,000 mobile apps is these are all Android apps. These are actually free Android apps, so we're actually able to download them, right? Is nearly half of these apps have no privacy policy. Now, that's not necessarily a problem, right, in the United States. Not necessarily a problem. It's only a problem, so let's actually zoom in, right, and look at these 48% of the apps that don't have a privacy policy, and let's actually see what these apps are actually doing, right? So when you're looking at what these apps are actually doing, some of these apps actually have a policy elsewhere, right? So there's no link, right, but so there's no link in the App Store to that policy, but if you dig deep, you can actually find a policy. And so that's fine. They've got a policy elsewhere. They're actually okay. Some of these apps don't collect any personally identifiable information. So by and large, they're not required to have a privacy policy. But about 71% of the apps that don't have a privacy policy actually do collect sensitive information and should have a privacy policy, right? So as you can tell here, one of the things that we see is that there's potentially 71% of the apps that have no privacy policy, which is about half of the apps that we've looked at. So that's about 35% of the free apps that we looked at, and it's a fairly representative sample that seem to potentially be in violation right there, right? So that's a huge amount of apps that potentially have problems. And that's a sign of who is behind the development of these apps, right? Those of you who are in my class, we discussed this actually yesterday evening, and we looked at the profiles of app developers. Many app developers have very little experience, right? They can write code that doesn't crash after some amount of effort, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they have the necessary sophistication to understand what they need to do when it comes to privacy. So there are tons and tons of app developers that just don't realize that there's even a need to have a privacy policy, don't realize that these laws apply, right? And so one of the arguments that I've been making now for a few years is I've been telling people that, look, the app developers are going to remain who they are. I mean, we can try and train them, and we should, right? But in truth, the onus should really be on the app stores, right, the App Store should be a much better job at offering these developers tools that will help them not just generate policies, but even understand how to generate good policies, policies that are not going to get them in trouble. Right. So we've looked actually at a number of different factors. So as it turns out, the more recent apps tend to actually have privacy policies, while the apps that have been around for a long time and have not recently been updated are less likely to have a privacy policy. So that's actually pretty good. That's a good trend, right? So there's actually a move towards having more privacy policies. Now, let's continue a bit more, a bit beyond this, and let's actually look at the apps that have privacy policies, right? So detecting that there's no privacy policy, you don't need all the technology that I've discussed so far to detect that an app doesn't have a privacy policy, right? Although you do need this technology still to do the analysis of the code and say, but this app really should have a privacy policy, and we've done that, right? But let's actually see what these apps that do have privacy policies, what do they actually declare? Do they actually declare that they're collecting information and sharing location? Do they disclose that they are collecting and sharing location information when they do, or do they miss disclosing that sort of information, right? So we've analyzed these policies. As I said, this takes about half an hour. We've built different algorithms to do that. And these are the kinds of results that you're getting, right? So those are results that basically indicate the presence of a given practice as being acknowledged in the privacy policy. So, for instance, you find that when it comes to, for instance, the collection of location information, about 34% of these apps, right, are actually disclosing that they're collecting collecting information, right? So it's interesting because if you look even at the top one, right, only 46% of the apps seem to describe their notification process for policy changes, even though this is required under CALOPA, the California Online Privacy Protection Act, requires you that you describe somewhere in your privacy policy how you're going to notify users if you change your privacy policy. Well, apparently only 46% of these policies disclose that type of information. And so there are clearly lots of different problems. Only 36% seem to describe user access, edit, and deletion rights, which is something that's required under COPPA for children. Not all these apps are intended for children, so we cannot necessarily tell very much on that basis. You would have to look at additional attributes to determine whether or not there's a problem. Sharing practices. So, for instance, if you're looking at location, L means location, sharing location, only 12% of these apps with privacy policies are disclosing the fact that they're sharing their location. As we're going to see in a minute, many more of them actually do, right? It's actually very easy to detect that, right? So major findings again. So we looked at the code analysis here, right? And we're looking for the presence of some of these practices, right? And so now what we're seeing here is we're going to look both at the apps with privacy policies and the apps without privacy policies. So look, for instance, at apps with privacy policies, right? So this is what is being reported here, right? And this is the percentage, right, where you actually have the percentage of times when in the policy you have a given practice, right? So 71%, for instance, of these apps disclose that they're sharing a unique device ID, but only 10% disclose it. So 71% of these apps, the code, right, you can tell looking at the code that they're sharing a unique device ID. Only 10% of them disclose that in their privacy policy. You can go back and see this here, right? So this is the percentage that we had here. That's the 10% I'm talking about, right? So in the privacy policy, you find that disclosure only 10% of the time. These are the exact same apps, right? When you look at the code, right, you find that this is actually happening 71% of the time. This gives you a sense for the discrepancies that we're talking about. So discrepancies are really, really prevalent, right? If you're looking at the apps without policies, right, it's also easy to see how bad things are. So, for instance, if you're looking at the six different practices that we've discussed before, right, you find that there's something like 16% of these apps with no policy that actually share your location, right? Under most of these regulations, if you're sharing location, you need to disclose that. So clearly, not having a privacy policy, you're not disclosing anything. This is a major problem, right? So let's see how we're doing with time here. What would you say, another 7 minutes?
Yeah.
Something like that? Sounds reasonable. Right. So that's an example of results that we can get, with this sort of technology, right? So you can offer these results both to people who are actually writing these privacy policies and help them write these privacy policies or help them identify that their code is doing things that are inconsistent with what their policy says and enabling them to realize that they need to modify their policy so that they are basically compliant again, right? And you can obviously offer these same technologies to regulators, right? Regulators are very interested in finding a scalable way. So regulators today, what do they do? Well, I took, for instance, the California AG. I have a project going on with them this summer. We're going to be using this technology and help them more systematically analyze mobile apps. Right? What they've been doing until now is they've relied basically on a small network of activists, right? Volunteers, who go and look at apps and then send, they notify the regulator saying, I found this app and it looks like it's doing something funny. Right? So this is extremely ad hoc. They've got no way of doing this in a systematic manner. Right? With this sort of technology, they might be in a position to finally do things in a much more systematic manner. It doesn't mean that they're going to go after everybody, but the kinds of things that regulators have done, the FTC, for instance, has been doing that now for a few years, is they send letters to people saying, it looks like you might have an issue. Here's a description of your issue. We're going to contact you again in a few months to see whether you've been able to resolve that. If you feel that, we made a mistake here, let us know, right? So it's not like we're coming after you, and we're going to shoot you down. It's more like, here's a warning. Please try to get your house in order, right? And if you feel that, we've not interpreted that correctly, let us know, right? So those are the kinds of things that regulators can do. Beyond that, regulators can use this technology also to identify trends, right? And see effectively what are the kinds of things that people struggle the most with in terms of compliance. So another area that we've been looking at using very similar types of technologies is whether we could actually help users overcome this challenge of dealing with the 150 permissions that I mentioned earlier, right? So using the same analysis of code that I've described earlier, where you're looking at what an app does, what information it's collecting, right, what permissions it requests, but also why it's requesting these permissions, right? The fact that Angry Bird requests your location, right, doesn't mean that Angry Bird requires your location. It's requesting your location because it's sharing it with advertising networks, right? There's nothing in the permission, whether it's on your iPhone or whether it's on your Android phone, there's nothing on your phone that tells you today the purpose for which your location is being requested. So for all you know, the app really requires your location. In truth, if it requires your location, you might be willing to grant it, but if it's requesting your location for different purposes, such as advertising, you may feel differently, right? Not everybody feels differently, but you may feel differently. You're not necessarily in a position to make a terribly, terribly meaningful decision here. And so the approach that we've taken is one where we've shown that we can actually learn people's privacy preferences, and we can actually recommend settings for them. And so I want to briefly describe how this works. I'll do this fairly quickly. But the basic idea, and this is work that we've been doing now for a few years, so we've seen these patterns from one year after the next, but we had never actually deployed this technology with real users. And so what I'm going to describe today is how we've gone and actually deployed technology that learns people's privacy preferences and helps them configure the many different settings that they've got on their phones when it comes to permissions requested by their mobile apps. So how does this work? I'm going to go fairly quickly. The first thing we've done is we've effectively tried to collect information about how people feel about a bunch of different apps and the permissions requested by these apps. And we've shown that it's actually possible to reduce these preferences to clusters of like-minded users, relatively small number of clusters of like-minded users, where you can effectively predict settings for all the users within the cluster with a fairly high level of accuracy. And so how do we collect information from people about the apps that they've got on their cell phones? How do you even get people to pay attention to the apps that they've got on their cell phones and modify privacy settings? So we could do a show of hands, but we don't have the time. But I could easily show you that most of you have no idea what permissions you have today with the apps that you've got on your smartphone. And so a technique that we've developed very successfully is a technique where we pop up messages and we inform users about the information that's collected by their apps, and we give them a chance to revisit the settings that they've got. And know that you told them what's going on, many of them are sufficiently motivated to pay attention to these settings. And if they don't feel comfortable with these settings, they go ahead and modify them. And what we do is we collect information about how they modify their settings so that we get a lot closer to understanding what their true privacy preferences are. Right? I can look at your phone today, right? Chances are that your settings are completely random. They're very permissive. They're very permissive because you've never been motivated to actually look at these settings. But these people who get our messages, such as your location data has been accessed 1,222 times over the past week by the following applications, right? Would you like to take another look? Would you like to modify your settings? When people see this message, if this is not something that they feel comfortable with, they go ahead and modify their settings. So this is actually very effective at even taking a relatively small number of users and converging towards preferences that are going to do a pretty good job at characterizing how they feel with regard to sharing information with different kinds of apps. Once you've collected this information from a meaningful number of users, and it doesn't have to be a huge number. In this case, we're actually able to do this with just about 100 users. You can actually organize these settings in groups of like-minded users, or what we call profiles. And so what you're seeing here are seven different profiles that collectively do a pretty good job at capturing the privacy preferences of people in our population of users. And so, for instance, here, if you look at this profile 3 here, and I'll briefly describe what you're looking at, you're looking at different kinds of permissions, right? So this is probably location. I think this is unique device ID. This is contacts list, right? You've got 6 different types of permissions. And along the vertical axis here, you've got different categories of apps. Why do you have different categories of apps when you try to represent people's preferences? Because you're not necessarily going to feel the same way when it comes to sharing your location, for instance, with a game app, right, that has no need to collect your location versus, you know, sharing your location with a navigation app, right, that clearly needs your location. Right? And so knowing the category of the app will clearly make a big difference in terms of how you feel. So this cluster of users here is actually very permissive. This other cluster of users, right, in red, shows you a group of users that's a lot less comfortable making these permissions available, granting these permissions to apps. And so this collection here of 7 different profiles does a pretty good job at capturing the preferences that people in this population of users has, right? And so the next question is, well, if you take a new user, you're going to try and find out which cluster, which profile is the best match for that user. And on that basis, you're going to then try to predict what settings that user might want to modify based on the apps that that user actually has on his smartphone, right? And so we've actually built what we call a privacy assistant that does that. So this privacy assistant uses these profiles. You download it on your phone. It looks at the apps, the actual apps that you've got on your phone. And on that basis, after asking you a few questions, determining which profile is a good match for you, it recommends a number of different settings, right? And these settings can basically be accepted, right? So in this case here, this is an example of a question that this assistant might ask you. It says, these travel and local apps have accessed your location 102 times over the past 2 days. How comfortable are you with that? Yes or no? So it's asking you 2 or 3 questions or 4 questions along those lines. Once it's asked these questions, it's able to effectively make recommendations like these ones. Right? So here it says, okay, it sounds like you're comfortable sharing your location with Facebook. You're probably not comfortable sharing your location with this Contacts Plus app. You're probably not comfortable sharing your location with News and Weather, and probably not also with Snapchat. Right? And the user can then decide which one of these recommendations to accept and which one of them to potentially reject. So we've deployed this, and if the user says, well, why does this thing recommend that I turn off Snapchat? It even gives you an explanation, right? Because the machine learning techniques that we're using enable you to actually go back and understand the reason why. So here, the social app accesses your location for app functionality and consumer tracking and profiling. And the consumer tracking and profiling is the reason why you don't feel comfortable with that. We've determined this through questions that we've asked you earlier, right? So we then went ahead and deployed this app, right, this assistant, with real users using it on their real cell phones, you know, with their real apps, and try to study how well this was working in terms of helping people configure their settings and to what extent the settings that they ended up with were truly settings they felt comfortable with. And this was actually a very successful experiment. So we had 29 people. We had a group of 51 users. 21 of them got the app. And another 22 were used basically as a baseline, right, as a control condition, as it's referred to in human subject studies. In this experiment here, we collected information from the users for 2 days to be able to ask them questions about whether or not they were comfortable with information collected by their apps, Then we gave them a chance to interact with the privacy assistant. They would modify some settings based on recommendations. And then for the following 6 days, we would send them a bunch of messages that were really intended to get them to rethink their permissions. And the reason for doing this is we wanted to see to what extent the settings that they had adopted after their interaction with the assistant were settings that were doing a pretty good job at reflecting their true preferences, right? The idea was that perhaps they were just nice to us. Perhaps they just agreed they just accepted our recommendations, but perhaps these recommendations are not doing such a great job at capturing their preferences. So let's see if we can motivate them to actually go back over these recommendations and go back perhaps to different settings. And so this is a chart that shows you the number of times that people accepted our recommendations and the number of times they did not. So this one user here didn't like our recommendations very much, but the vast majority of users accepted most of our recommendations and declined a few of these recommendations. Right. So the statistics overall, users accepted about 78% of the recommendations. And what's most important is that they only went back over some of these recommendations about 5% of the time. So we tried for 6 days to get them to revise their settings after their interaction with the assistant, and they only modified about 5% of these settings. We conducted interviews and all sorts of other things. By and large, the vast majority of these people said, can we please keep the app? We really like it. It's very helpful. And so that sounds very promising. And so this is where I'm going to quickly wrap up. So we're doing this for mobile, and we've had actually a good amount of success. This is research funded by Google. The PhD student who's actually been working on that was just hired by Google a couple of weeks ago. So who knows what will happen next. But we're not stopping here. So now we're exploring ways of generalizing this approach to IoT, right? And in IoT, things are even more complicated because, as I said, I'm going to walk into a room and there's going to be a bunch of different devices and services. Some of them are actually invisible. So how do I enable people, right, to still remain in control of what's going on, to be informed about the things that they care about without swamping them with information, right? If you have 20 different devices in this room, you don't want to have to read 20 different privacy policies. There are probably just a couple of things that you would want to know about. And if there are any settings available, right, so perhaps you could request that the camera, you know, doesn't do facial expression recognition. You might be able to opt out of that. Perhaps you can request that, some other devices or some other sensors, you know, do not necessarily track you or perhaps just aggregate your data. There are also different settings that you might want to make available. So how do you get users to potentially configure these settings without overwhelming them with a number of different decisions. So the kinds of scenarios that we're playing with, and I'm going to keep this at a fairly high level, are scenarios where everyone who owns a resource, an IoT resource, a sensor, an application, what have you, has the ability to register that resource in a registry. And as you enter a building or room, and you have tons of these registries around, right? As you enter into a room, you're able to discover that registry. You're able to discover the privacy policies associated with that particular resource. Your privacy assistant is able to understand that privacy policy. It may decide that everything that's being disclosed in that privacy policy is absolutely fine by you, and there's no need to inform you about anything. Or it may discover one little thing that perhaps would get you very upset or that you would want to know about. It might just tell you about that one thing. And if it discovers a setting, it might try to actually configure that setting on your behalf based on knowledge about your preferences, or if it doesn't know enough about you, it might prompt you and ask you to decide how you want to modify that setting. So we're actually implementing this right now. We're going to be deploying this over the next few months, both at Carnegie Mellon, and we've got also collaboration with UC Irvine, where we're deploying this also in a couple of buildings. And so that's in a nutshell what we're doing. So I'm going to quickly wrap up. You've been very patient, or perhaps you've just all fallen asleep. I'm not sure which one. So what I've tried to show you is that notice and choice is critical, but it's clearly not scalable, right? And we need entirely different technologies. We need technologies like machine learning, like natural language processing, to help us overcome, right, the scale issues and the usability issues that arise when it comes to trying to keep people informed about the collection and use of their data in these IoT scenarios. And we also need technologies that are capable of learning our privacy preferences, so that as we evolve in these environments, privacy is not something that you want to have to think about every minute of your life, right? You want to perhaps think about privacy a couple of times during the course of the day. Right? And so you want this technology to just raise a flag a couple of times, potentially prompt you to get you to make a decision because the assistant doesn't know enough about you. And then the rest of the time, you want this thing to operate in the background. Right? That's roughly what you want. Any more than that would be unacceptable. It would be too burdensome. We're not ready for that, as far as I can tell. And so I've shown you, hopefully, that the kinds of technologies that we're developing in these two projects are technologies that are actually quite promising, right? We've got results already today that seem to be very meaningful in terms of helping companies, helping regulators, and helping mobile app users. And so we're hoping, obviously, this is far from being done. There's a lot more work that needs to be done in this space. But we're hoping that at some point these technologies will actually be adopted commercially as well. And so that's in a nutshell what I wanted to talk about this evening. And I'm going to stop here.
That's very good. Thanks very much.
Sure.
Now,